I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
And it's evening in Baghdad. Sirens have sounded again around the city. The weather has cleared over Iraq, and U.S. and British forces are now stepping up their military campaign from the air and on the ground.
Coalition forces continue to encounter guerrilla attacks on the way to Baghdad.
Reports yesterday that a convoy of hundreds of Iraqi vehicles had moved south from Baghdad to challenge Allied troops were addressed today at Central Command in Qatar by Brigadier General Vincent Brooks.
Coalition forces of the U.S. 5th Corps were attacked by vehicle-mounted irregulars, where there had been a report of some significant number of vehicles approaching. The reports were not accurate in terms of the size of the force, and 5th Corps units soundly defeated the attack, destroying most of the force.
Brigadier General Vincent Brooks, today at Central Command in Qatar.
Meanwhile, this morning, President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair met at Camp David. Topics on the agenda were the progress of the war, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and the role of the United Nations. In a post-meeting press conference, Blair emphasized the importance of the restoration of the UN Oil for Food program for Iraq.
Because that is the thing we need to get sorted out with the United Nations literally in the next few days. Now, after that, there's the issue of the post-conflict administration, where, as we said in our resource statement, it's important there again that the UN is involved and that any post-conflict administration in Iraq is endorsed by it. But there are huge numbers of details to be discussed with our allies.
Well, joining us on the line now from Washington, D.C. is Maura Reynolds, White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Maura, what were the expectations of this meeting, and what are you hearing may have actually come out of it?
Well, it's not exactly clear. I mean, they were going to discuss this difference over the role of the UN in a post-conflict Iraq, and they were also going to discuss the very difficult problem they have right now over distribution of humanitarian aid from the Oil for Food program. It seems that they've decided to put off the first problem and to deal primarily with the second one.
But remind us, the difference was?
Well, the difference is that in terms of post-conflict Iraq, that Tony Blair just 2 days ago was saying that the UN should play a central role in any administration and not just in distributing humanitarian aid, but also in determining the reconstruction of the country. The U.S. plan has been to move more or less directly from U.S. military governance to an Iraqi authority that would be chosen by the Iraqi people. They would hope for some kind of U.N. endorsement of that program, but not that the U.N. would be primarily involved in organizing and running that. And so they've decided, I think, at this point, not to talk about that because it is so incendiary, because the French and other Security Council members are clearly very emotional about this, and to concentrate on the humanitarian needs of Iraq right now and the need to get the Oil for Food program aid into Iraq in the nearest future.
Well, both leaders were pressed on the timing of the war. We heard President Bush a few minutes ago say, as long as it takes. They mentioned the Middle East peace process, big emphasis on that. But anything else in the few seconds we have that surprised you?
Well, just that they seemed so testy about it, both of them. It's clearly, I mean, to President Bush's credit, he did say from the very beginning that the war could be longer than many were anticipating. And now that many of us were taken in by the most optimistic scenarios, he seems a little testy at the moment now that he's, you know, at the suggestions that maybe the war is taking much longer than had been anticipated.
Well, Maura, thank you.
No problem.
Maura Reynolds, White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
More than 1,000 paratroopers drifting down in the dark into northern Iraq. A vision more like something from World War II than the kind of combat operations U.S. troops have tended to engage in since then. U.S. military officials say that for now, the Rangers and soldiers of the 173rd Airborne are meant to protect the Kurdish zone in northern Iraq, though that could change.
The capabilities of that force may be more than what meets the eye. Let's say that first. They can be used offensively, and if we choose to use them that way, then that's indeed how they'll be used. But I'm not going to allude to exactly how they'll be used as time goes on.
Brigadier General Vincent Brooks this morning at Central Command's daily briefing, and now we're joined by Here and Now's correspondent Michael Goldfarb in northern Iraq. Michael observed the paratroopers today as they settled into their foxholes. Michael, welcome.
Hello, Bill.
Michael, what have you seen?
Well, I think settling in is probably a euphemism. The weather here has been fairly abysmal for weeks now, and they were scooping out large chunks of mud from the area around the airstrip at Harir, setting up positions, it looked to me, about every 50 yards. And as we were driving down a back road on the far side of the airport, we came across a group of about five soldiers walking back down the pavement, and we asked them about landing in the mud. We thought it might actually help them jumping out of an airplane to land on something soft, and they said it was actually just too muddy and that it actually made the jump rather difficult.
Now, Michael, commanders are apparently saying that the airborne was brought in by parachute to secure the airfield. Why weren't they just flown in on airplanes?
I must say the area into which they have come, the airfield at Harir, is well inside the Kurdish-controlled area, protected on two sides by mountains, and it's hard to understand exactly why the fellas had to jump.
Michael, what's your sense of the situation in northern Iraq at this point?
Well, I think that in northern Iraq, people have finally got used to the idea that forces here, both Kurdish forces and whatever American forces are ultimately based here, are not really going to be in action anytime soon. If you do the math, you see they got 1,000 in last night. And if you did that every night for a week, you might just be getting to the troop numbers necessary to try and take Mosul and Kirkuk, the two big cities up here. But you still wonder how they're going to get in enough armored equipment and transport equipment. So I think people here are accepting the need for patience.
Here and now's Michael Goldfarb spoke to us from northern Iraq.
Well, Iran. As I was saying, Iran, a country that neighbors Iraq, has been strangely silent. But according to a report in tomorrow's Jane's Intelligence Digest, Iran and the U.S. are communicating discreetly. Alex Standish is editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, and he joins us from London. Alex, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
First of all, Iran runs along the eastern border of Iraq. It's a country that looms over Iraq, looks to be about twice the size. The southern Iraqi town of Basra, which is so beleaguered right now, appears to be right on the Iran border. So what role is Iran playing in this conflict?
Well, up till now, Iran is very much doing its best, I think, to keep out of the firing line. It does have an active involvement in Iraqi politics because it sponsors the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is an organization of Shia Muslims. But I think at the moment there has been an agreement between the U.S. and Iran. It's a very informal agreement, we understand, negotiated very clandestinely, but that Iran will do its best to keep out of this conflict.
Just in reading from some of the Jane's papers, apparently Washington is having talks with Tehran through India.
Well, I've heard this. My sources also suggest that the actual contacts have been brokered via Switzerland, and they are, of course, being routinely denied by both sides because the conservative wing of the Iranian leadership is very much opposed to any form of contact with the United States at all. And those contacts might well put the more moderate government of President Mohammad Khatami in a very difficult position politically. So I think we're not going to see any face-to-face televised talks at this stage.
But what are some of the details of Iran's role? For instance, has there been any discussion of the use of airspace by U.S. or allied forces or a downed airplane or a misfired missile? Have there been any talks about that kind of interaction?
Well, as I understand it, there is an agreement that nothing will be said very publicly about misfired missiles, provided, of course, that they don't hit large civilian populations or cities. Mm-hmm. As far as the issue of the airspace is concerned, as we understand it, there is already an operative agreement in place to allow search and rescue missions in the case of downed aircraft. That would not, of course, constitute allowing bombers, for example, to overfly Iranian airspace. So I think there is a limited agreement, which has been presented as a humanitarian option to allow the U.S. to go and retrieve its fallen pilots.
Do you think there's any chance that Iranian forces would actually be drawn into the conflict? We mentioned Basra, which has a large population of the Shia Muslims. Do you ever see the Iranian forces being drawn in to fight alongside or protect them?
Well, at this stage, I think it's unlikely. There has been some speculation over the last couple of days that Iranian forces might be massing across the border from Basra. But as I understand it, this has been denied by both sides. The only thing that might give rise to some concern is that the Iranians have advised, I think is the right word, the US and its allies, to avoid targeting the Iraqi Muslim shrines, specifically the Shia headquarters at Najaf, where there's been fierce fighting. And, you know, I think that really would be a nightmare scenario if a cruise missile were to sort of hit that. I think that would be extremely serious.
Like hitting the Vatican.
Absolutely. I think one of the difficulties is it's more to do with the population, because some of these populations are far more militant than their governments. The governments see things from a geopolitical stance, and they really don't want to be drawn into this conflict. I mean, there's no way, for example, Damascus would send troops, but there's no way they can stop Syrian volunteers who decide to go across the border and fight with Saddam, for example.
But can Iran stop volunteers who might want to fight the U.S. if, as you say, a holy site is struck, or might want to protect Iraqi Shias from Saddam's forces?
Probably not. I think they would strongly discourage it at the moment. I mean, clearly, if the situation in Basra became a major disaster and Shia were being killed as well, and then I think it would be very difficult to stop militant groups who are not necessarily under the control of the central government in Tehran getting involved. But I think at the moment, after that terrible war in the 1980s, the eight-year war, the Iranians have no stomach for getting involved as a government in this mess. I think they're quite relieved, although they dare not say it publicly, that the US is going in to sort out Saddam, because they've always feared that they may be a target on his hit list at some stage in the future.
And finally, I'm wondering if you would see that the outcome of this conflict could potentially lead to a major shift in US-Iran relations.
I don't think that this is going to see a major thaw of relations. I think this is a temporary alliance rather than a fundamental shift in policy.
Alex, thank you.
My pleasure.
Alex Standish is editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. He spoke to us from London.
A siege of Baghdad. What challenges await and how will Allied troops conduct the critical fight for control of Iraq's capital?
That's ahead. And later, health officials struggle to halt the spread of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome.
And remembering former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
From the beginning of the U.S.-led war in Iraq, the central strategic objective has been the same, Baghdad. At this hour, U.S. forces continue to mass outside the city. Right now, it seems the most optimistic scenario contemplated by U.S. planners has not played out. There's been no Iraqi coup, no mass surrender of Republican guards. So Baghdad, home to 6 million Iraqis, a quarter of the population, a massive city spread over 2,000 square miles of flat land on either side of the Tigris River. How will this city, roughly the size of Los Angeles, fall? We're joined in the studio by Colonel Khalif Sepp, formerly with the U.S. Special Forces. Thank you again for being with us, Colonel.
Thank you, Bill.
And joining us by phone is Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, U.S. Army, also retired, and author of Beyond Terror, Strategy in a Changing World. Welcome, Colonel.
Delighted to have a chance to talk to you and your audience.
Colonel Peters, thanks. How does this happen? Do U.S. forces go in and take Baghdad street by street, building by building?
No, absolutely not. Baghdad ultimately will fall from within, not from without. All these wild claims you hear that somehow Baghdad will be Stalingrad on the Euphrates, a bloodbath for American troops, are simply wrong. We are not going to engage in street-by-street, house-to-house fighting. Now, there certainly may be some local incidents of urban warfare for specific objectives, but we have time. If the regime does not collapse after the series of battles that are looming right now on the outskirts of Baghdad, then we will patiently draw a cordon around the city over a matter of weeks, if that's what it takes, over a couple months, if that's what it takes. And once Baghdad is essentially surrounded, remember, at that point, we can focus virtually all of our national intelligence resources on it. We'll have special operations teams roaming the back alleys and hallways of Baghdad. We'll have Iraqi agents in there. We'll be able to do very precise targeting. As we capture more of these Iraqi generals and colonels, and many are surrendering right now, by the way, we interrogate them. Then we learn, yes, that's where the secret bunker is that we never found. But we will not waste American or Iraqi civilian lives by creating a battle within Baghdad.
Yet, Colonel Sepp, down along a 300-mile line, our troops are being harried by much more resistance, Pentagon officials have admitted to some news organizations, than they expected. Do we have enough soldiers in country to confront this city of Baghdad and still deal with all the other military operations and confrontations going on south of Baghdad?
This is clearly a growing concern among the senior military leadership. And a siege of Baghdad, to expect it to be effectively surrounded by perhaps only 30,000 combat troops, is something that remains in the theoretical range. This is a bit like Henry V at the siege of Harfleur. He's a long way from the sea. And in fact, there's another side to this, a darker scenario, that time is not on our side. As long as Baghdad stands, all the outlying cities that that we're currently having difficulties with, Basra, Tirqit, Mosul, may well stand as well and require more troops to be drawn to battles there.
I think really Colonel Sepp and I are very close to agreement. I really think we need more troops. The one strategic miscalculation of this war that really has troubled me is the fact that Secretary of Rumsfeld put a troop cap on and give General Franks all the soldiers for whom he asked. Now, we're rushing troops in. More are arriving. The 4th Infantry Division will get there. So we need to, you know, not be precipitous. Haste makes waste, especially in war. Take our time and do it right.
Colonel Sepp, I ask you, a siege of Baghdad, why would not these troops just resist and resist and resist? That does create problems if this goes on too long, does it not?
That's exactly one of the dark scenarios, that in that time that the city, even if it is effectively cordoned off, that the troops loyal to Saddam will find themselves, in the context of the Arab world, reveling in their status as heroes, and this will further extend the siege. And then what's just happened in Basra is something of an indicator that the option of being able to wait outside of Baghdad for an internal collapse may not be an option. If there is an uprising inside Baghdad that seems to be being crushed by the internal security forces of Saddam Hussein, if we do nothing, if we do not fight our way into the city to help that uprising, then, once again, the scenario goes completely black.
You know, yesterday a very important positive development happened that people kind of missed. When we all heard about that column of up to 1,000 vehicles leaving Baghdad, that wasn't tanks and armored personnel carriers. Those were the Fidayeen, secret policemen, the very people Saddam needs to continue terrorizing Baghdad. He is desperate. I mean, I don't think people realize how badly the war is going for Saddam. So, well, I don't want to be a Pollyanna. I remain very much an optimist.
But Ralph Peters, I want to ask you, why will a city fall if the people within it still have water, still have electricity? If you're too humane in a siege, why would a city fall?
Well, a city will fall because we will be able to focus on that city, and we will find Saddam and his henchmen one by one.
Colonel Sepp, just to finish then, let me throw out one more wild card. Chemical weapons. What if he uses them?
At the tactical level, the troops have a very simple approach. They're ready for them to be used. And it's very difficult to get the concentrations necessary to have a very effective military impact.
Chemical weapons, doesn't matter whether he uses them or not, as far as the coalition succeeding in the siege of Baghdad.
Well, it helps us, actually, because he uses chemical weapons, then the world sees that he has them. He exposes himself. And one way or another, we're going to win, and we're going to keep this fight going relentlessly until it's over.
I still wonder sometimes about Saddam Hussein and the people around him in a bunker somewhere 6 months from now.
To return to the image of Henry V at the walls of Harfleur, Shakespeare has him deliver a speech to the mayor, and he threatens the complete destruction of his town and the slaughter of all its inhabitants. And it's at that point that the mayor opens the gates and Henry enters the city. It would be hard to imagine that if he had been catapulting bags of grain over the walls to feed the citizens, that that would have been the outcome.
You know, I'm a Shakespeare fan myself, and we are much less Henry V and much more Prospero.
I want to thank both of our colonels. Kalev Sepp, Special Forces Colonel, retired. Thank you, Kalev.
Thank you, Bill.
And Ralph Peters, retired Lieutenant Colonel and author of Beyond Terror, Strategy in a Changing World. Thank you for joining us, Ralph.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the mystery virus that's made thousands sick around the world.
Why lawyers are on the front lines in Iraq.
The Army's mission is to fight and win the nation's wars, and lawyers need to be there to help the Army do that.
And we talked to a Muslim Air Force chaplain about the challenges of serving in the U.S. military while practicing Islam.
Clearly, post 9/11, we're human. It does foster a certain amount of animosity towards those who are of Arab descent, who are possibly Muslim.
These stories and more, coming up here and now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. Coalition forces in Iraq are making steady progress, but will require further sacrifice. This from President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair in a joint news conference today. After a summit at Camp David, Bush announced the two leaders have agreed to ask the United Nations to resume its oil for food humanitarian aid program as soon as possible.
More than half the Iraqi people depend on this program as their sole source of food. This urgent humanitarian issue must not be politicized. And the Security Council should give Secretary General Annan the authority to start getting food supplies to those most in need of assistance.
When asked how long the war would last, President Bush said, as long as it must. Tony Blair emphasized the war is just a week old and there is no point in setting a time limit.
In just under a week, there is a massive amount that has already been achieved. I mean, after all, coalition forces are within 50 miles of Baghdad. The southern oil fields are secured. The West is protected from external aggression. We've got forces going into the North. We will carry on until the job is done.
The leaders also discussed provisions for post-war Iraq. Blair is continuing to push for a more involved role for the UN than President Bush has advocated. New York City's busy Fifth Avenue was blocked today as anti-war activists lied down in the middle of the roadway to symbolize Iraqi war victims. 150 people were arrested at the demonstration. It attracted many counter-protesters. The demonstrations are costing the city millions of dollars in police overtime, according to Police Commissioner Ray Kelly. Health officials around the world are imposing quarantines in an attempt to prevent the spread of a mystery illness that resembles pneumonia. At least 1,000 people in Hong Kong have been told to stay home for the next 10 days or risk going to jail. Meanwhile, voluntary quarantine is in effect for thousands of Canadians who visited a Toronto hospital, which is now shut down by an outbreak of the mystery illness. U.S. Airways is the latest airlines to announce a reduced schedule, saying the war in Iraq is causing fewer people to fly. Starting next week, the airline suspending flights on routes connecting Europe to Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, some of the flights. Total departures for U.S. Airways are now down 4%. Delta, United, Continental, and Northwest have made similar moves in the last 2 weeks. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 78 points to 8,151. The Nasdaq is off 12. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In Hong Kong, nearly 1,100 people are under government-imposed quarantine. In Singapore, 840 people confined to their homes. And in Ontario, Canada, public health officials are urging thousands to take part in a self-imposed quarantine. All these measures being put into place to stave the spread of a new virus that world health officials are calling SARS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. The sometimes fatal illness appears to have originated in China, and all those who have contracted it so far have recently traveled to China or Hong Kong, or have come into contact with those returning from the region. So far in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control has confirmed 45 cases. Joining us to discuss SARS and the situation in Canada is the president of the Ontario Nurses Association, Barb Wall. Welcome, Barb.
Thank you, Bill.
Barb, what's the situation in Ontario? We've heard reports of 27 confirmed cases of SARS as well as voluntary quarantine.
There are many confirmed cases. 27 is the number at one point in time. The numbers are increasing. Then there's a next level of people who are ill, but it's not confirmed that they have SARS. And then I have to tell you, there are thousands of people who have now been told that they must be quarantined in their homes. They're all in the Toronto area. It started with three patients who died. They had, in fact, been in Southeast Asia. But there wasn't recognized what that condition was. 13 nurses and others became ill. They're now in an isolated hospital. And all of the people who were in that hospital where those three patients were have now been told to quarantine themselves. We're talking of thousands of people. We also have other patients in other hospitals.
How do you catch this disease if you haven't been to Southeast Asia or China?
The disease is spread by droplets. If I sneezed on you and I had it, you would most likely catch it if you were vulnerable. And also it can be spread by hand contact if I haven't washed my hands. So it's a very easily spread virus, and it's also a very strong virus in that people do become ill. You're more at risk if you're elderly or have other conditions.
Now, do people get better from SARS? We heard at the onset of this crisis that there was no cure for it.
That's the problem, Bill. We don't know enough yet. We know that those people who traveled back from Asia directly and were hospitalized, those three have died. We know of another one who is in severe situation in a different hospital, and others are hospitalized. But the incubation period is 10 days, so there are other people who are demonstrating symptoms, but we don't know how sick they are. I think the most critical thing is that if there's any suspect of this, that there must be immediate isolation of the patient. That isolation means gowning, gloving, and masks for the caregivers to protect the patient and to protect the public.
So what do you do briefly to make somebody better?
Yeah, there's a broad scope of drugs that are being used. The problem is that it's not known yet for sure what causes this, and that's what makes it so frightening. We're saying, as the Nurses Association, that we want any nurse or any other healthcare provider who has contact with people off the street to be fully protected. That means gowns, masks, gloves, because you have to protect those people because otherwise they're part of the spread of the disease. And then you also have to protect them in order to keep a full group of healthcare workers up on their feet. Because what we're seeing is the thousands who are quarantined from the one hospital, many of them work part-time somewhere else, so they're no longer available to do health care, to do nursing care.
Barb, how are people in Ontario taking this, the general population? Is there a sense of fear out there?
Yes, there is a sense of fear. I've had a provincial meeting of nursing leaders from around our province for the last few days and ongoing today. We're talking a lot about what people should do, and we're saying to the public, don't visit your loved ones in nursing homes and in hospital right now unless it's absolutely essential, because you don't need to be part of the movement of people back and forth and virus. Anyone could be having it at this point in time. We're suggesting that the first line of defense is completely covered with isolation material, with gloves, masks, that if possible, clinics in these vulnerable areas, you know, where you go to have your ears checked, let's cancel them. And for the public, hand washing is critical.
Thank you for speaking with us, Barb.
Thanks, Bill.
Barb Wall is president of the Ontario Nurses Association.
Former New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan died yesterday at Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C. His death was announced on the Senate floor by the successor to his Senate seat, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
We have lost a great American, an extraordinary senator, an intellectual, and a man of passion and understanding about what really makes this country great.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, four-term U.S. senator, ambassador, Harvard professor, the son of a single mom in New York's Hell's Kitchen, who became the most erudite of politicians, a devout liberal who advised President Nixon on race relations, an Irish Catholic whose support of black Americans was often met with controversy. Moynihan is remembered today by colleagues like Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank.
He was a guy who understood that one of the important roles of government was to provide for people who couldn't provide for themselves. When it became fashionable to turn your back on the notion of welfare for the poorest people, Pat Moynihan really used all of his prestige to stand up. And he also showed, very important back when he did it, that a liberal Democrat, as he very much was someone who was for helping the poor, for fighting racial discrimination, for cleaning up the environment, and also a supporter of a strong America and a proud, patriotic American, and a supporter of a vibrant free enterprise system.
But many of his ideas about those things you just listed were often misunderstood by other liberals. I'm thinking of the phrase that he used in the early 70s when he advised that that benign neglect be applied.
That was the one. I agree. And that phrase, benign neglect, while I understood what he meant by it.
And what do you think he meant?
Namely, that you try to alleviate the conditions without talking about the racism that much.
Yeah, tone down the rhetoric.
That you don't talk about the most inflammatory aspects, but you work very hard on correcting the conditions. You know, Pat was a man with a great way with words. He was a very eloquent man. And I sometimes people who love words like this can get a little intoxicated with the phrase.
Well, Congressman Frank, I want to close. In front of me, I have the comments that this great Irish-American made on November 24th, 1963, 2 days after President Kennedy
being
was
Irish
killed.
Means that your heart's going to get broken.
Right. I don't think there's any point in being Irish if you don't know that the world is going to break your heart eventually. I guess we thought we had a little more time. And then Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, so did he. And he was speaking, of course, of President Kennedy.
Well, I think he can feel, or he had a right to feel toward the end of his life, that he had done his part to extend all the good parts of John F. Kennedy in his own public life.
Congressman Frank, thank you.
You're welcome.
Congressman Barney Frank, remembering his colleague, former New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who died yesterday at the age of 76.
Still to come, lawyers, guns, and soldiers. Why attorneys are part of the frontline fighting in Iraq.
Also, a Muslim chaplain at a U.S. Air Force base talks about the challenges of practicing Islam while serving in the U.S. military.
You're listening to Here and Now. On Thursdays, we read your letters, and not surprisingly this week, they concern war.
Just before the bombing of Baghdad began, Pat Westwater Jung of Bolton, Massachusetts, sent us this email. I've been frustrated by many people on NPR who say we should attack Iraq because Saddam Hussein is dangerous and we need to stop him from attacking us. Why can't we learn this from the IRA in England and Israel and the Palestinians? As soon as one group kills innocent people for the crimes that other people committed, they incur the wrath of the murdered's loved ones.
Listener Mark Bolio was hopping mad when he heard our interview with Amy Hamilton T-Bear, who dressed as the Easter Bunny to protest Kmart's inclusion of toy weapons in Easter baskets. Mark writes, I don't need her to save me from an Easter basket. I think anyone shopping for one can certainly decide on their own if they want peeps or guns in it. May I suggest this well-meaning young lady use all that time and energy on something more useful, like her local soup kitchen? There's a lot of vets down there who need her.
March 17th, the day President Bush warned Saddam Hussein that bombing would begin if he didn't leave Baghdad, Isaac Taylor of Cambridge wrote, good grief, what were you guys thinking putting that Shania Twain segment on the air? Never mind the fact that your music critic just lost all credibility endorsing that self-congratulatory hack. There's a war on, for crying out loud.
Well, several listeners questioned our daily military analysis. Doris Cardigan wrote, you talked about the use of overwhelming U.S. air power, but the use of overwhelming force is a moral issue. Why don't you have a moralist on the show, too? It's wrong to just air this military mindset.
Listener Larry Lopez had this response after hearing about reports of Iraqi soldiers dressed as civilians and attacking U.S. forces. He writes, gee, Iraqi troops in civilian clothes. I guess the U.S., U.K., Aussie special ops folks never do that, huh? Maybe if you talked with someone other than U.S. military and embed reporters, INBED, you might get a more accurate perspective.
Also commenting on reports of Iraqi troops in civilian clothing was Joyce Barraway of Nantucket, Mass., who left this voice message.
French aid workers who are working in Afghanistan at the moment have reported that their mission has been complicated by the presence of U.S. military dressed in civilian clothing in Afghanistan, and that it creates great distrust and confusion amongst the Afghan civilians as to who is who. I just wanted to report what had come to mind as soon as I heard about Iraqi soldiers being dressed in civilian clothing. Thank you.
But there were other views of our war coverage. Rob Ricciardelli writes, could you possibly show any more contempt for our military forces? I'm sure the BBC's sneering coverage is a bonus as well. Cheers.
And finally, before the war even began, we received an avalanche of mail from listeners who were moved by Robin's essay on the recent tough winter, the looming war, and the suicide of her close friend, Kim Prince, and the homecoming of Elizabeth Smart. Jerry Quinzo of Boston wrote, I was sitting stopped in the endless traffic, feeling irritated, when I heard your moving tribute to your friend. Suddenly, tears were streaming down my face, but I felt tranquil. Your friend was clearly a wonderful person. Elizabeth Smart was found. Spring will come. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And we always love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Lawyers, not the kind decked out in pinstriped power suits, but the kind who wear camouflage uniforms and insignia, are presently accompanying U.S. and British troops all over Iraq. To find out why, we're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Risch, who's an instructor at the Army's Judge Advocate General School in Charlottesville, Virginia, where military lawyers are trained. Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Colonel Risch, why are lawyers out there in harm's way at this point in this war?
Because over the past 5 to 10 years, the military services have come to the realization that commanders need to have lawyers as part of their staffs, advising them on myriad issues that arise during combat operations as well as during peace operations.
What kind of issues?
It runs the gamut. Your standard things that lawyers have always dealt with, wills and powers of attorney, but now you've got, in the operational law arena, it's called, we deal with rules of engagement, law of war problems, and the like.
Now, let me ask you, what do you do, Colonel, when the other side isn't playing by the rules? Soldiers in civilian clothes, Iraqi soldiers in civilian clothes we hear about, human shields fighting from inside a hospital.
It's especially important, I think, when you have a situation that the other side does not seem to be complying with the law of war. That's when we need to get in and ensure that our troops understand the training they've received before and continue to comply with that law of war and not get caught up in a situation where they might want to disregard those laws because the other side is disregarding them as well.
Now, military lawyers have clients. Their clients are commanders. Would a military lawyer even go to the point of helping a commander select a target, depending on what the law would allow in targeting something?
That's somewhat correct, sir. We're just another factor that the commander weighs into the overall decision-making process as to what targets to engage. Obviously, our piece is to help the commander determine whether or not a target is lawful pursuant to not only the law of war but the rules of engagement that have been set by higher command.
Wouldn't that slow down a decision-making process in the heat of combat?
We certainly don't try to slow that process down, but it is a vital and necessary portion of the targeting process, and commanders, especially the savvy commanders, understand that. And our Army Chief of Staff, General Shinseki, has even gone so far as to indicate that lawyers are a vital part of that process.
And more than ever, right?
That's correct.
Why did it happen in the past 5 or 10 years? That lawyers became so much more embedded, if you will, with troops. What brought on that change?
Well, I guess you could say we have certainly become a more legalistic society over that time, and it's a process that has just evolved. The military has come to the realization that that there are legal issues. They've always been there. They're just much more sensitive to those legal issues, and we have really pushed ourselves in to become integrated with the units, to become soldiers first who happen to be lawyers, so that we're out there in the places that our military goes. I mean, the Army's mission is to fight and win the nation's wars, and lawyers need to be there to help the Army do that.
The role of lawyers in the modern U.S. military. Thank you very much, Colonel, for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Risch, an instructor at the Army's Judge Advocate General School in Charlottesville, Virginia, where military lawyers are trained.
The 101st Airborne has left Kuwait and is on the move toward Baghdad. Last weekend, a member of the 101st allegedly tossed grenades into tents. Two soldiers were killed and 14 others were wounded after the apparent fragging, a Vietnam-era word meaning to kill a fellow soldier with a fragmentary device. Reporter Don North is embedded with the unit survivors.
Many of the soldiers told me that it really hurts to have one of their band of brothers turn on them like that. It certainly dampened morale briefly, but these are professional soldiers, and it didn't stop the war effort at all.
Well, the man suspected of tossing the grenade, Sergeant Asan Akbar, was taken into custody. Akbar is one of 4,000 Muslim soldiers serving in the U.S. military. And joining us now on the line from Biloxi, Mississippi, is Hamza al-Mubarak. He's the Muslim chaplain at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi. And, chaplain, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, how is this rippling through the Muslim community where you are?
Well, as far as the individual, as it's been stated in the media that he's a Muslim, it has been reported to me from another colleague, an Army Muslim chaplain that's over there in Kuwait, that the individual is not actually a Muslim, but he's a 5%er. And that is an offshoot belief system group, predominantly out of the New York area, which is an offshoot from the Nation of Islam.
But what I guess what I'm hearing is there a need to maybe distance from this man on the part of the Muslim community, maybe even yourself?
Well, no, not an aspect of distancing. Even if it comes out in the end that he was an observant Muslim, it's a tragedy, bottom line, that senseless lives were lost.
Does it have any impact at all, given that there's been so much tension between Muslim Americans and other Americans post 9/11?
I could only imagine that it would. Have I experienced any? None whatsoever.
It's also been reported in the New York Times that some relatives and friends of Sergeant Akbar are saying that he claimed to have problems with racism. Do you see any of the black Muslim soldiers that you work with at the Air Force Base, do you see them ostracized or in any other way treated differently because they're Muslim?
Not that I've noticed, but the past year I was deployed overseas into the AOR. I can share with you an incident with an Army troop who had clear problems, one that was expressed to me because he was black. Second was compounded because he was Muslim, and he slept with me in his tent. He didn't feel safe. Clearly, post 9/11, we're human. It does foster, I would say, a certain amount of animosity towards those who are of Arab descent, who are possibly Muslim.
If you listen to some of the heated talk radio, you hear people asking, "What was a Muslim doing in the U.S. military after 9/11 anyway?"
Well, Let me draw from a seminar that I attended. I was on the same platform and was addressed the question, you know, should I worry about if there's a Muslim in the foxhole? My reply was, one, from the Muslim paradigm, is it permissible for one Muslim to kill another? No. In the Quran, it states, anyone who kills another man, it is if he has killed all of mankind. Anyone who saves a life, it is if he saved all of mankind.
Well, Chaplain, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Chaplain Hamza al-Mubarak is the Muslim chaplain at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi.
And before we go, this summary of some of today's developments in the war with Iraq.
Skies are clear over Iraq, and U.S. officials say more than 600 air raids were conducted today, targeting Republican Guard formations around Baghdad.
President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair concluded a meeting at Camp David to discuss the first week of war. This morning, they stood side by side at a joint news conference, urging that the U.N. Oil for Food program for Iraq be restored right away.
Prime Minister Blair also referred to the deaths of two unarmed British soldiers, saying they had been executed. President Bush accused the Iraqi forces of murdering captured soldiers, calling it a war crime.
More confusion from yesterday's missile attack in a crowded Baghdad neighborhood that killed 17 civilians, while the Pentagon said it didn't direct any bombs or missiles into that neighborhood. Eyewitnesses, reporters on the ground, and news outlets around the world are laying the blame on U.S. forces.
But today, Brigadier General Vincent Brooks said the tragedy was Iraq's responsibility, citing faulty military stockpiles.
They're also using very old stocks, we've discovered. And those stocks are not reliable, and missiles are going up and coming down. So we think it's entirely possible that this may have been, in fact, an Iraqi missile that either went up and came down, or, given the behaviors of the regime lately, it may have been a deliberate attack inside of town.
And the battle of words continues, and Iraqi military spokesman is accusing U.S. and British officials of exaggerating their war progress and hiding losses inflicted by Iraqi troops.
The Arab satellite television network Al Jazeera is responding to criticism after airing footage of dead U.S. and British soldiers, saying they have a duty to show the world casualties on all sides in the war.
In the south, a captured Iraqi airfield was renamed Bush International Airport.
And the Solomon Islands have said thanks, but no thanks, after discovering they were unknowingly listed as one of the countries in the Coalition of the Willing.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.